The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Beautiful, beautiful day here at Edstone, the last broadcast, well, for the weekdays, I guess, but we've got another Sabbath special scheduled for tomorrow. It'll be 2 hours later than the normally scheduled time as far as the live broadcast goes, so that means 3 p.m. here in the UK and 9 a.m., at our headquarters campus and at the headquarters facilities of KPCG in Edmond, Oklahoma. So we hope that you'll tune in live for that that production. We continue to get strong numbers for all of the live broadcasts as well as the podcast later. Several thousand listening in each day. So we certainly do appreciate you following along with us, even in this time of much turmoil. And there's quite a few articles, I'll get to them in the second segment, quite a few articles pointing out what we were talking about just a couple weeks ago, how that the cure is worse than the problem. It's worse than the disease, and more officials, more and more commentators are beginning to wake up to that fact. Mr. Hilliker sent me an article just a few minutes ago. From Zero Hedge, the virus is no longer the problem. What we need to be preparing for is the other problems that all of this government action has brought on. And we're starting to see it already. Already, just a few days into it. Just a couple days into the lockdowns. And now you're seeing politicians the world over scurrying about trying to figure out, how do we turn this around? How do we get it back to the way it was before Corona? Well, we'll get to that in a little bit later. There's just so much to cover, so many different angles to this story, and so many of them, they're not good. But first, I just want to focus in on something that will tie right in with our Days of Unleavened Bread, the period we're in the midst of right now, in the book, John's Gospel, The Love of God. My father admonishes us to build a resurrection from the dead now kind of faith. That's quite an admonition. To have this kind of living faith, a resurrection from the dead. A resurrection from the dead now kind of faith. Living faith. The kind of faith Jesus Christ had. In The Plain Truth About Healing, Herbert Armstrong wrote, "Yes, even as you and I may be, Jesus was filled with the Holy Spirit, God's Holy Spirit, God's dynamic supernatural power. This power of God Almighty, the Creator, was literally in Jesus." He says, "And the same identical power of the same identical living God may be within you today." You can draw on that same power, he wrote. You can receive the same power that Jesus received. How about that? And we've thought about, at this time of year, the ministry of Jesus Christ, the life of Jesus Christ, the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And even today, Jesus Christ lives. And we've gone through that as well. He's our advocate, our high priest, our intercessor. Let's look over at Matthew 27 and verse 52. This is what happened, or one of the things that happened, right at the time of Jesus Christ's crucifixion. It says in this passage that he cried out with a loud voice and yielded up the human spirit. This is in Matthew 27, the veil of the temple was ripped in two. There was a massive earthquake, these stones split in half. And here in verse 52, it says, "And the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints which slept, that means they were dead, physically, they were dead, many bodies of the saints which slept arose and came out of the graves after his resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared unto many. So these were individuals at that time that had died, well, fairly recently, shortly before Christ's crucifixion. And here they were, resurrected to physical life. And they just waltzed right into Jerusalem and made their appearance known. And I'm sure the people that knew them before they died were just shocked. They were dead, and now they were brought back to life. Well, it's not like that hadn't happened before during the ministry of Christ. Of course, it even predates Christ's ministry. If you go back to some examples in the Old Testament with Elijah and such. Luke 7, though, let's just focus in on the ministry of Christ for a moment. Luke 7 and verse 11, it says, "And it came to pass the day after that he went into the city called Nain, and many of his disciples went with him, and much people. Now when he came near to the gate of the city, behold, there was a dead man carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, and much people of the city was with her," it says, "and when the Eternal saw her, he had compassion on her, and he said unto her, weep not, don't cry. Here was a grieving mother. She had just the one son, a widow." Verse 14 says, "And he came and touched her," or touched the bier rather, "and when and they that bare him," or that were holding him, "stood still. And he said, young man, I say to you, arise. And he that was dead sat up." He that was dead sat up, it says, "and began to speak. And he delivered him to his mother." So this happened right in the midst of a funeral procession that was working its way through town. Everybody was there to witness it. This young man who was dead, he rose from the dead. It says, "And there came fear on all, and they glorified God, saying that a great prophet is risen among us, that God has visited his people. And this rumor of him went forth throughout all Judea and throughout all the region round about." Well, you can see why. The news of this spread. It spread across town. It spread throughout the region. It spread like a wildfire. Here was a man who raised this young man to life. What a miracle. Of course, these were just resurrections to physical life, and there's other examples of that. You can read about one in Acts 9 with Tabitha and Eutychus in Acts 20. It wasn't just Jesus Christ, it was the disciples of Christ carrying out Christ's will, looking to the same God that Jesus looked to, building the same kind of resurrection from the dead, now faith, living faith. So here are these examples of, as I say, resurrections to flesh and blood, physical life. None of them, of course, were raised to immortality, except Jesus Christ, of course, 3 days after his crucifixion. But these were all resurrections to physical life, and they lived for a short time longer. Christ, however, was raised to immortal life, eternal life. And that's the resurrection that we can look forward to if we believe. If we have resurrection from the dead now, faith, God the Father and Christ the Son, they have power over the grave. And there's many examples in the scriptures that show just that. What a powerful demonstration of living faith. Here are these people who were dead, they were raised to life. And then they glorified God. And then they thanked God. Here we are in the world today. We're in the midst of a health crisis. And so many people are putting their faith, their trust, their everything, their confidence in Western medicine, which makes quite a few mistakes We're not supposed to talk about that. The deaths brought on by medical malpractice, an estimated 250,000 per year in the United States. That's a lot of mistakes. As Western medicine goes about trying to save lives, and they're certainly praised. They're being praised here in the UK. I don't know if it's a nightly thing or what. I saw the clips of last week, I suppose, of the people lining the streets, even as they're in quarantine, to cheer the NHS, the National Health Service. That, like one commentator said last week, that's the closest thing the UK has to a national religion. The health service, the nationalized health care. Listen to this exchange. This was on Piers Morgan's show here in the UK. And again, you watch this and it has all of the elements needed to be a heartwarming story. This survivor's family, I think all of them came down with the virus. He's 61, the one you'll hear here in a moment. His father was well into his 90s, I believe. He died because of coronavirus. And then this man, his wife got it. He was in the hospital for 12, 13 days. I think he was in intensive care for a few days. And he survived. He comes out of it. And of course, he heaps praise upon the NHS. But then listen to this question. Piers Morgan asks, and then his response, clip one.
I was going to say, you studied history at university, and I think I read somewhere that you said that you couldn't think of any invention in history to rival the National Health Service from your experience.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, if you look back to all the glorious moments of our story, I genuinely do think that the NHS is our crowning achievement. I mean, how can one have an institution at such scale, but full of so many people who are imbued with care, love, compassion for others?
Now, you look at the story, what that man has gone through, and there's going to be exactly no one that would dare criticize anything that he just said there. But that's the legacy of the British Empire? That's the greatest invention in the history of the British Empire? We were chatting yesterday, a few of us, and I think it was Richard Palmer who said that Great Britain basically gave up the empire for the NHS. I told him he needed to put together an article on that. When you talk about all that the empire coming out of World War II was giving up and relinquishing, even as it was developing this nationalized health service, which in the minds of many is probably similar to what you just heard there. This is our national religion. This is the greatest invention in British history. This is the most glorious moment of our story. It comes back to what my father said in that coworker letter that just went out this week. The irony that we're willing to put our complete and total faith and trust in the institutions of men. But the moment someone says to you, look, this is what God commands. Well, how dare you tell me what I should or shouldn't do or what I should or shouldn't believe? How dare you come along and say I'm not obeying this law of God? It's a heartwarming story, as I say, but it also reveals a painful truth. The fact that we've made a God out of our religion, or rather a God out of our Western medicine. That's the religion today. Mr. Armstrong, remember in the healing booklet, he talked about, I've played that or given you that quote a few times, talked about the power of the medical experts and how that the medical expert, the Surgeon General, has the power to even quarantine the President of the United States. And that's what we see happening in the world today. The power of these experts to quarantine the whole Western world. And now they're beginning to see that the estimated deaths, it's not near what they thought it would be. And then the economy's ground to a halt. How can we turn this around? How can we get this back going in the right direction? Of course, there's a lot, as I've pointed out, there's a lot from among the radical left in the United States that they don't want to see it turn around because they know this is their only hope for victory in November. This is the systems of men. Men get in there and try to fix it, and they end up mucking it up even more. Mr. Armstrong once said, "The only hope that God gives for any life after this life is the hope of the resurrection." That's what we want to set our hopes on, our desires. That's what we want to set as the ultimate goal. And whether we live to 30 or 50 or 70, we want to secure our place in God's kingdom, where we'll live forever and ever alongside Jesus Christ and God the Father. They have power over the grave. John 11, this is the account regarding Lazarus. People are very familiar with this. Notice verse 1, it says, "Now a certain man was sick named Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary was anointed, the eternal, with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore his sisters went unto him, saying, 'Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick.'" So Jesus knew this young man. He was familiar with the family. It says, "When Jesus heard that, he said, 'This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby.'" That's Christ's reaction. Look, it's not a sickness unto death. It's going to glorify God in the end. Notice Jesus didn't react hysterically and say, "Oh no, what should we do? This is dreadful. This is terrifying." He answered as you would expect Jesus Christ to respond. "Well, this sickness is actually going to bring God glory. How about that?" Verse 5, "Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. When he had heard, therefore, that he was sick, he abode 2 days still in the same place where he was." So he evidently wasn't in any hurry. "Then after that, he said unto his disciples, 'Let us go into Judea again.' And just his disciples said unto him, 'Master, the Jews of late sought to stone you, and go you there again?'" So here's this trial with Lazarus. Jesus says, "Let's go to Judea." Disciples say, "Well, you've got persecutors there trying to kill you. Are you sure you want to do that?" This is a man with faith in God. Now, he had wisdom. There were moments when he did avoid certain crowds because of the persecution. And then, of course, there was the moment at the end when he faced right up to it. Verse 9, it says, "And Jesus answered, and are there not 12 hours in the day? If any man walk in the day, he stumbles not, because he sees the light of this world. But if a man walk in the night, he stumbles, because there's no light in him." Then verse 11, it says, "These things said he, and after that he said unto them, 'Our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may awake him out of sleep.' And then his disciples said, 'Lord, if he sleeps, he shall do well.'" What's the big thing? Of course, they thought he was just sleeping like you and I go to sleep at night. "Howbeit, Jesus spoke of his death, but they thought that he had spoken of taking of rest in sleep." In my father's book, John's Gospel, he says, "If we're going to let Christ live in us and have the faith of Christ, we must learn to view death as he does. We must strive to view everything as he does." See, the way Christ viewed it, Lazarus, even though he had died physically, he was just sleeping. He was just taking a nap. And as he would later say, Jesus, that is, I am the resurrection. I am the life. He was just going to go and wake him up, just like he's going to wake up the saints in the years ahead at the return of Jesus Christ. Verse 14, then said Jesus unto them plainly, Lazarus is dead, and I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, to the intent you may believe. Nevertheless, let us go unto him. So he was trying to teach them, these disciples, he was trying to show them how weak they were, faith-wise. They didn't have resurrection from the dead now, faith. They didn't have living faith. Now, that would come later through the power of God's Spirit. Verse 17, then when Jesus came, he found that he had lain in the grave 4 days already. So 4 days, Lazarus had been in the grave. And Martha and Mary, of course, were beside themselves at that time. Verse 20, then Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went out and met him. But Mary sat still in the house, and then said Martha unto Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother had not died. They really believed that if Christ, the Son of God, would have been there before he died, that he could have saved Lazarus. But now that he was dead, they thought, well, it's too late. It's too late for God. It's too late for Jesus. Verse 23, Jesus said to her, your brother shall rise again. And Martha said to him, I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day. So these are people that really understood a lot of the doctrines of the church. She obviously took this to mean that, well, I know he's going to be resurrected in the first resurrection. I know he's going to be brought back to life later. But of course, here they were right in the midst of Jesus Christ. In the book, John's Gospel, it says Jesus Christ, in one sense, simply didn't recognize any difference between healing or resurrecting someone then and there and bringing someone up in a resurrection at a later time. It says, if we have the faith of Christ, there is no difference. It's the same thing. If God intervenes to heal us of physical sickness, or to resurrect those bones, those dry bones out of the grave, it's the same miraculous power of God in either case. Verse 24, Martha said to him, I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Jesus said unto her, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believes in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. I am the resurrection, said Christ. I'm the one who's going to raise those individuals from the dead. So why should you think it's so difficult for me to do that even now? Verse 26, and whosoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? Do you believe? Are you a believer? Do you have resurrection from the dead now? Faith? Do you have this kind of faith in God the Father, living faith? Martha went out and retrieved her sister, and they came in again to see Jesus. Verse 32, then when Mary was come where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying unto him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother had not died. She said the same thing that Martha had said. In verse 33, when Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews also weeping, which came with her, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled. And then verse 35 says that he wept. Jesus wept. He wasn't crying because, well, he wasn't crying for the reason that the others were. They were grieving uncontrollably. Jesus wept because of their lack of faith. You see, God and Christ, they view physical death much differently than we do. They're concerned about eternity. They're concerned about our birth into the immortal and eternally living family of God. Here was Christ groaning in his spirit, troubled by their faithlessness. Verse 36, then said the Jews, behold, how he loved him. See, they saw Jesus weeping and thought, well, he must be grieving for Lazarus's death as well. And some of them said, could not this man, which opened the eyes of the blind, have caused that even this man should not have died? Well, if he would have just gotten here a little bit earlier, he could have kept Lazarus from dying. In fact, Jesus took his time. He wanted Lazarus to die or to go to sleep. This was a miracle that would glorify God. In the book, John's Gospel, my father says, we must be thinking and studying about God resurrecting us. However, we cannot attain that goal unless we build the faith of Christ and exercise it today. You think about all of these, and it's not just victims of the virus. We've been into statistics now, right across the board, 152,000 people on earth that die every day. A few thousand of them now because of a virus, and a few thousand more because of the so-called cure. But what is this life? And why are we here? And what should we be preparing for? This is the message. This is the message the world needs. It's the only hopeful message. To place your hope, your faith, your trust in the institutions of men, in a nationalized health service, or in the hands of a medical expert, you're going to end up being very disappointed in the end. It says here, so during these feasts, God wants our minds on being resurrected. He helps in every way he can, so we will build the faith needed to be resurrected. We will have lost everything forever if we are not resurrected into God's family. You see, that's all that matters, the resurrection into God's family. If our life, our physical life, is extended for a few more years, and yet we miss out on this, what will it matter? As Hebrews 9 says, we all have an appointment with physical death. It's given to man once to die, but after that, the resurrection. That's where we want to set our sights. That's where we want to really fix our gaze. The resurrection that comes later. Verse 40, Jesus said to her, said I not unto you that if you would believe, you should see the glory of God? You just have to believe in faith. You just have to trust me. You just have to follow. Verse 41 says, then they took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. This is quite a prayer, by the way. Very confident, very bold prayer. And I know that you hear me always, but because of the people which stand by, I said it that they may believe that you have sent me. And when he had thus spoken, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. Here is Jesus Christ. He thanks the Father. That's the kind of faith that we need. He thanks God before he then asks for God to raise him from the dead. That's Hebrews 4, 14 to 16 kind of faith or prayer. They both go together, that's for sure. Praying with the kind of boldness that Jesus Christ prayed with. Verse 44 says, and he that was dead came forth bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound about with a napkin. And Jesus said unto him, loose him, and let him go. And then many of the Jews which came to Mary and had seen the things which Jesus did believed on him. Many of the Jews believed on him. There were others that went right to the Pharisees and the Sadducees as well and said, hey, this man's gaining too much popularity. His message is resonating with too many people. We need to put an end to this. We need to go after him. We need to persecute him. I went through some of that with you the other day. But to just finish on this point, this resurrection from the dead, now faith. Here's what my father wrote in John's Gospel. It says, if the Father would give his only begotten Son to die for our sins, you know he is serious about having a family. He laid everything on the line, taking a chance of losing the Word forever. Isn't it logical that he would then require something of us? If he's that serious about having a family, we must become that serious about entering that family. It says, we desperately need the faith of Jesus Christ. That faith enabled Christ to endure his trials to the death. It was by faith that he conquered, and we can have that very faith in us by the Holy Spirit. It's just like Mr. Armstrong said in the healing booklet. That same faith that empowered Jesus Christ, the Son of God, our Savior, our soon-coming King, our husband, we can be filled with that same resurrection from the dead now faith. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Untold thousands of professing Christian ministers have, over the centuries, preached Christ. They have professed to be his ministers, to represent him. They have said Jesus of Nazareth is the Christ, but they have withheld Christ's gospel. Thus, the vast majority of people on earth have been deceived by false gospels. The incredible human potential reveals how men were deceived about the truth of the gospel, and it makes plain what the good news of the true gospel really is. The true gospel of God's coming kingdom is directly concerned with world conditions as they are, with human nature, its source and origin, with world evils, suffering, unhappiness, with world peace. It's concerned with government, with the reason present human governments fail to be the benefactors of their peoples they are supposed to be. This all-important subject is thoroughly explained in Herbert Armstrong's book, The Incredible Human Potential. Request The Incredible Human Potential today. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
Over the last few weeks, we've been talking about the many different ways this coronavirus crisis is impacting end-time prophecies of God with respect to Europe. My father's program, by the way, that plays this weekend, how that it's bringing the 10 kings together in Europe. And we know there's going to be 10 because of Revelation 17, so it's going to look a fair bit different than what it does right now as the European Union. So when you see these stories, like in the Times, the coronavirus crisis could blow the EU apart. That's significant. That's significant. It says, by constructing and then refusing to fix the Eurozone, they have created the circumstances in which the EU itself could be blown apart by the coronavirus crisis. Well, they've got this big 540 billion euro package to try to save the Union, but not all the states are happy, as you would imagine. It says, this escalating economic emergency is a tragedy for the peoples of Europe, but their leaders created a madcap creation, a currency and monetary and fiscal construction that is not capable of swiftly transferring resources to the weak in the worst crisis since the Second World War. So in other words, it's just too big. It moves too slow. And we can't get it down to the nations that really need it, these bailouts or the funds coming from it. So it's causing a lot of division and a lot of strife. And soon there's going to be a massive shakeup that then leads to these 10 kings emerging, rallying around the Daniel 8 strongman. And they're all going to work together just for a short time, but they're all going to work together as one. That's what Revelation 17 says. So these earth-shaking developments, we're going to see a new Europe, and soon. Meanwhile, in the states of Israel, or the Israelite countries, the United States and Britain, you see it just continuing to drive our economies into the ground. In the United States, 16.8 million Americans have lost their jobs in just 3 weeks. 3 weeks. That has happened in the past 20 days. 16.8 million Americans. It shows just how fast and dramatic these earth-shaking changes have happened. Listen to Senator John Kennedy. He's from Louisiana. And of course, Louisiana down in New Orleans, they've been hit fairly hard by the virus. And yet here is Senator Kennedy, a Republican, saying we've got to restart the economy or the problems are just going to get worse. This is clip two.
Our numbers are headed in the right direction. We still have to be vigilant. But while we save lives, we've also got to get started saving livelihoods, Sean. We got to get this economy back open. This economy has been chewed up, spit out, and stepped on.
And then the leaders think that that's not going to have any adverse effects on people, their livelihoods, on the rates of depression or division in family, suicides, that sort of thing. It's from Zero Hedge, just about the state of Tennessee. Last week it says the more people died of suicide in Tennessee than from COVID-19. And here's Zero Hedge saying, as we previously warned, this pandemic will bankrupt and kill more people from suicide than the virus will. When you sacrifice people's livelihoods, you create a difficult situation of desperation for many who will see no other way out. And then it goes on to say that the virus here is no longer the problem. It's the government's reaction to it. And that's what we've been pointing out for the last several weeks. We make the same point in the latest trumpet. It's the government's reaction now that's going to become the focus here in the next few days. It already is in some cases. It says the government's reaction has been the problem, and even some politicians have figured it out. Knox County Mayor Glenn Jacobs revealed in a weekly update that our solution to this pandemic has not been a good one. It's not solved the problem. Surprise, surprise. It quotes this mayor of Knox County. He says, thus far, our reaction to COVID-19 has been to sacrifice the global economy. The truth is, a sick economy produces sick people. Did you hear that? A sick economy produces sick people. That's what we're about to see on a widespread scale. There was a story from also at Zero Hedge. I think it's actually quoting from Reuters or AP, I forget. But here it is, talking about what people are doing with their time now that they're locked in their homes to cope with lockdown stress, it says, job loss, and or just being housebound and bored over the last month, millions of Americans have resorted to watching porn, drinking beer, smoking pot, and or devouring chocolate amid coronavirus lockdowns that covers at least 90% of the country. That's from Reuters. This is how we're filling our time. These are the activities that we're engaged in. Well, we've got all the time in the world, so what are we doing? Well, there's precious, precious few listening to programs like this. The overwhelming majority, however, consuming all kinds of pornography and alcohol and drugs. You think that'll solve our problems? You think we'll come out of this that much better because of it? Well, some, like the mayor of Knox County, they're beginning to see that something's dreadfully wrong here with this solution. The Zero Hedge author here says, most people don't want to hear the truth, unfortunately, and the longer state governments insist on businesses being closed and an economy shut down to combat what's looking like a fairly insignificant virus for most of the population, the aftermath will worsen. It says each day that drags on will make the next few years more difficult. But you see, we don't have the models out for the next few years. Or even if we do, the Telegraph says there are some models coming out about the effects of this in the months ahead, in the years ahead, with respect to suicides and things like that. But how do you compare that with the running daily tracker? It's right there on your computer. You're seeing people die right now because of the virus. That's all that we want to be concerned about. That's why the mayor, or rather the governor of New York, would say, if everything we do saves just one life, it's worth it. It's totally worth it. There's our leaders going forward, looking at what looked like a little spot on this microphone right here, focused in on that spot and seeing nothing else. Nothing else in the world. 16.8 million losing their jobs just in the United States. Fraser Nelson had a piece at the Telegraph titled, Boris Johnson is worried the lockdown has gone too far, but only he can end it. And you know what the article basically says? Well, he's in a pretty difficult position to end it. He's got a third of his cabinet that thinks they should end it. A third thinks that they should lock it down harder. And then the other third that's just kind of like, well, you know, what's the public opinion? And so there they go, divided, hanging on every opinion poll, and nobody has the courage to lead. Nobody has the courage to reverse a tragic wrong, or even to come forward and admit error. Dr. Fauci said yesterday the estimate's down to 60,000. Well, you could focus on just that number alone and think that, well, that's still tragic. But listen, we've gone from 2.2 million down to 60,000. And President Trump, he has said in his briefings that he shut down the economy because two smart people came into his office and said, if you don't, 2.2 million people are going to die in America alone. So this is the action that they chose, and they're finding now, boy, it's hard to roll it back. There's quite a lot of it, as I've already pointed out, that you can't roll back. You can't roll back the $2.2 trillion bailout. That's law now. Fraser Nelson says, work is being done to add it all up and to produce a figure for avoidable deaths that could, in the long term, be caused by lockdown. I'm told that the early attempts have produced a figure of 150,000, far greater than those expected to die of COVID. This is, I assume, he's talking about here in the UK, 150,000 casualties as a result of the cure. But like he goes on to say, this, of course, is a model. And we don't have very much faith in models anymore, do we? It's a model, just like the model for COVID deaths produced by Imperial College, but estimates of lockdown victims are being shared among those in government who worry about the social damage now underway, the domestic violence, the depression, even suicides accompanying the mass bankruptcies. But these are deaths, he says. These are deaths that may or may not show up in national figures in a year's time, It's hard to weigh them up against a virus whose victims are being counted every day. Every day we're seeing them counted right in front of our eyes. And of course, those doctors, especially in the United States, they've been told, look, even if you don't test them, if they look like they had COVID-19, just mark it down as a COVID-19 death. We've got to get those figures up after all. We've got to get, at least it's lowered to 60,000, the estimate. So we've got to try to get it up at least to 60. Otherwise, we're just going to look foolish. And then, of course, there's the political motivation that's driving it as well. So much of it. They want to continue on scaring the general public, insisting that the lockdown continue for months on end. Here in the UK, you have Boris Johnson. He's in a bind. Of course, he's recovering himself, so he's not really in the condition he needs to be in physically to make a strong stand. President Trump is in a similar position, a difficult one. His attorney general, by the way, he gave I'll have to get to some of his comments maybe next week, but he had an interview yesterday, Attorney General Barr, where he talked about the overreach, these draconian measures, and how that it did concern him, how that some of the liberties, the civil liberties, the freedoms that Americans enjoy, how that those have been suspended because of this emergency. Here's what Mr. Barr said yesterday, clip 4.
You're right in the general sense that there is a power for the government to take extraordinary steps in genuine emergencies. That obviously creates a slippery slope. What do you call an emergency? And I am concerned that we not get into the business of declaring everything an emergency and then using these kinds of sweeping extraordinary steps.
That's right, the precedent. That's what he's concerned about now. There's no going back from this precedent. What's to stop us in the future if the experts come along and say, hey, have you seen this model? Do you know what's about to happen? And then it's just lacking entirely any context or perspective. There was another article, by the way, about Queens. We talked a little bit about this earlier in the week. Just why, you know, here they are in Queens, crammed together, living on top of one another, and how this is the epicenter. These are your modern cities. New York City. This is from the New York Times. It says, in a city ravaged by coronavirus, few places have suffered as much as central Queens, where a seven square mile patch, that's what we're talking about here, 7 square miles. These hundreds of thousands of people living on a patch of earth that's just kind of like a little narrow strip from here at Edstone down to Stratford, and they're all crammed together in Queens. It says here, a 7 square mile patch of densely packed immigrant enclaves recorded more than 7,000 cases in the first weeks of the outbreak. It says, yet healthcare workers and community leaders say it is indisputable that the pandemic has disproportionately affected the Hispanic day laborers, restaurant workers, and cleaners, who make up the largest share of the population in an area often celebrated as one of the most diverse places on earth. This is, well, we're proud of this community. Lots of diversity. They're all crammed together. It's beautiful. It's the American way. It says Latinos comprise 34% of the deaths in New York City, the largest share for any racial or ethnic group. Says the neighborhoods also have large communities of Indian, Bangladeshi, Chinese, Filipino, and Nepali people, and a score of other ethnicities that have been devastated by the pandemic. Now listen to this. The city-run Elmhurst Hospital Center was one of the earliest and hardest hit by the virus. Dozens of COVID-19 patients have clogged hallways as they wait for beds, terrified. Why would they be terrified? Because the media is saying you're going to die. If you catch this, you're going to die. So here are all these people from Queens. They're huddled in these hallways together with all these other victims. They're terrified, it says. They're alone, and they often are unable to communicate in English. So it's like a perfect storm for the spread of disease. This is obviously not the way it is in a lot of other areas of the United States. But this is the model. How many times has Governor Cuomo said, what's happening in New York? What's happening in New York City? What's happening in Queens? It's coming to Lincoln, Nebraska. It's coming to Pensacola, Florida. It's coming to Topeka, Kansas. That's the model. And the model before that, Northern Italy. And the model before that, well, what was it? Neil Ferguson, Imperial College, millions and millions dying in the streets. It says the chock-a-block density that defines this part of Queens may have also been its undoing. Doctors and community leaders say poverty, notoriously overcrowded homes, and government inaction left residents especially vulnerable to the virus. You get to that several paragraphs in, but that's not going to make it to the nightly news. The nightly news is, this is obviously President Trump's fault. Obviously, it's the president who dropped the ball here. What you're seeing or what you just heard described in Queens, that has been the Queens of this year and last year and 5 years ago and decades ago. And nothing is done about it. Nothing from the mayor. Nothing from the governor. It just continues on. It just persists. And then there's this very contagious virus. And no wonder it rips through this community more than any other. Look at the way people are living. And yet, as bad as it's been there, still you have the experts, as I say, in full retreat. Here's Dr. Fauci yesterday, lowering, once again, it happens every 3-4 days, lowering the estimate. Clip 3.
Do you think the number of fatalities in this country will be significantly lower than the 100,000 to 240,000 first projected?
I do. I believe we are going to see a downturn in that, and it looks more like the 60,000 than the 100 to 200,000. But having said that, we better be careful that we don't say, okay, we're doing so well, we could pull back.
See, they'll say the same thing if it comes down to 20,000. Having said that, we better be careful. We can't sacrifice one life to this. We can sacrifice tens of thousands to other things. The 250,000 or so that die in U.S. hospitals because of medical malpractice, that's nothing. Just brush that aside. The people dying from other infectious diseases, the ones that die from the flu, even if it's tens of thousands every year, yeah, that's no big deal because it's kind of stretched out. Nobody thinks anything of it. It happens every season. But this is where we need to have our focus. And we need to keep telling the public about it so that these poor people living in Queens, when they show up to the hospital, they're just absolutely terrified that they're going to die any moment. We get in there in all of our vanity and arrogance and think, this is all you need to do to solve the problem. Let's expand the size of government. Let's print more money. Let's extend the lockdown. And everything will work out fine in the end. It's astounding to me that there aren't more. A few are beginning to wake up, but it's astounding to me that there aren't more that are willing to come forward and say, we made a mistake. Can we just try to correct it as soon as possible? You think about the spirit of the days of unleavened bread. What would our lives be like if the approach that we took was, well, okay, I'm going to go this way, no matter what. This is the way I'm going. And then it's proven to be tragically, tragically wrong. And if we just persisted, if we just continued in a hard-headed, stubborn kind of way without repenting and turning to God, the problem, it's not just that it would never get fixed. It would get so much worse and worse And worse, this is turning into a train wreck, a massive train wreck right in front of our eyes. It's like it's going in slow motion. And out trot the experts every day. Well, we've revised the models. You should know that this is a little bit, this is good news, but we can't relax. We can't open up anything. We have to keep doing what we're doing. Or it might even get up to 60,000. The cure, as we're now finding out, and we're going to find out a lot more about it in the weeks and months ahead. It's a lot worse than the disease. There's quite a few other stories about how they're counting the deaths. We'll spend some more time on that next week. There's also some pretty revealing stories about the hospitals here in the UK, in the United States. A lot of this action was justified by the fact that we've got to save the hospitals. We can't have everybody running into the hospitals all at once. Is that happening? Has that happened? Well, we'll look into that a little bit more next week. That's about all that we have time for, though, on today's program. Don't forget about the special Sabbath broadcast. That's coming up tomorrow, just 2 hours after our regularly scheduled time. Of course, if you don't hear it live, you can always get to the podcast later. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We thank you for joining us all through this week of programming. And once again, we'll see you tomorrow.